Hello, and welcome to Tolerable Risk, the podcast for NGO, nonprofit, and charity professionals who manage risk. I'm your host, Sabrina Siegel. Today, we're going to talk to Alexandra Hoffman. Alexandra is the CEO of Crisis Ally, which helps crisis leaders and their teams build the right capabilities to thrive through crises. Crisis Ally serves clients internationally. Thanks to a career with the French government and large international corporations, Alexandra has a rich operational and multicultural experience with strong expertise in business resilience. In addition to supporting organizations, she also writes for ASIS Security Management Magazine and the Crisis Response Journal. Alexandra, thank you so much for coming on Tolerable Risk today. I'm really excited to have you on for this episode where we're going to talk about crisis and resilience, which is something that a lot of people have survived through in the past few years, but I'm really interested to hear your point of view on it.
Thank you very much, Sabrina. Hello. Hello to you and to your listeners. I'm super humbled to be here because I've listened to a few other guests that you've had in the recent past and super impressive people. So I'm really, really honored to be with you today.
Thank you. You're super impressive too. So we're happy to have you. Before we jump into the topic today, though, can you just tell the listeners a little bit more about yourself? How did you get into this line of work and what are you doing now?
Yes. So I'm Alexandra Hoffman, and I've been in the security industry my entire career. I started back in 2003, I would say. Yeah, 2003, 2002, back in the US in New York, where I studied corporate security. And that's also where I landed my first job in corporate security. And from then on, I built my entire career around corporate security. Spent a couple of years with the French government when I went back to France. But most of all, I'm a pure product of the private sector where I've learned the job. And the thing is, when you do security, you deal with incidents and crises day in and day out. And this is when I figured this was something that was really interesting and that was also something I'm good at. So over the years, I developed that skill and competence. And in 2019, I decided to set up my own company around business resilience. I was basically tired of those silos inside organizations, and I wanted to do something different. I wanted to go big and have a more holistic and systemic approach because I think this is the way to approach this topic. So here I am today with my company, Crisis Ally, and we serve clients globally, mostly in Europe and the North America because of time zones, right? We're super proud to serve those clients, international clients in the private sector, sometimes in the public sector as well. I've also had an opportunity to support NGOs as well, also because I was a volunteer with a couple of NGOs in the past, including the American Red Cross and French Red Cross. So it's a sector that's really, really close to my heart. And that's also one of the reasons I'm super happy to be discussing this with you today, Sabrina, because I know, especially when we look at what's going on today in Turkey and Syria, that those organizations need support, whether big, medium, or small. And so I'm all in to give my 2 cents on this topic, basically.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Alexandra. I love your approach where you're talking about how it has to be holistic and it can't just be siloed, because I feel the same way when it comes to risk management. So definitely we're kindred spirits there. So let's get started. Can you just tell us, so that we're all sure that we're understanding the terminology correctly as we talk about this today, what is crisis and what is resilience?
I would define crisis as a disruptive event. And I like to use the disruptive event term because it's all encompassing, basically, whereas a crisis is already something huge, right? So definitions can vary from one organization to the next and can be also very subjective depending on what you do in your organization, whether you're an NGO or something else. So I like to talk about the disruptive event, something that really happens at one point in the day during the week that really disrupts your regular normal, whether it's COVID, whether it's an earthquake, whether it's a car crash, whether it's anything. So that's my definition of a crisis, to be a disruptive event. And I would also include to that, it's a disruptive event for which you don't have the tools, right? Otherwise, it's not a disruptive event. If you have everything at hand to handle it, then it's not a crisis. It's not a disruptive event. So you don't have everything at hand to handle it right away. So already you have to use innovation, adaptation, and agility, all of those soft skills to handle the situation that's coming up. And that goes hand in hand with resilience.
Great. And so when we're talking about crisis and resilience, when you're talking to clients or just talking to people, what do people get wrong? What do they misunderstand about these concepts?
I think there's at least two things. The number one thing that's still coming up today, despite what went on with COVID, is that people keep on building silos. Even today, when we talk about resilience, people had to come up with, you know, organizational resilience, supply chain resilience, financial resilience, or reputational resilience, and so on and so forth. I think it's a mistake because it's building yet new silos, and it's not going to help. So that's number one. And number two is, unfortunately, because this is the easy way in, we still focus way too much on hard tools. What I call hard tools are the documents, the frameworks. And I know more and more are also looking into people mindset and culture and all of this, but the focus is too much on hard tools. And every day I'm speaking with clients, every day I see this. So focusing too much on the hard tools and really keeping on building and focusing on silos. And I know it's actually part of who we are as humans because we want to simplify things. And resilience is a big topic. Crisis, you know, disruptive events are really big. And sometimes we see them as huge mountains, like Everest Mountain. Like, how do I get up there, right? So we want to go step by step. So we build those silos. And this step-by-step approach, I'm all in for that. But building silos between people, I think, is a big, big mistake. And because between people and specialties and expertise, that's my point here.
So let's assume, right, with crisis, so disruptive events, we can try and see if we can predict them. We can certainly try and do scenario planning so that we can be prepared for them. But ultimately, we can't really control them. But resilience, I would guess, maybe is something that organizations and individuals can learn how to do or improve or practice or strengthen. So can you talk a little bit more about what exactly does resilience mean? And if you can talk about it from a low to no resourced environment as well, that would be great because folks listening to Tolerable Risk are working in charities and nonprofits and typically don't have a lot of resources at hand. So can you talk a little bit more about what does resilience mean in those environments when you're responding to a disruptive event?
This is the perfect transition to what I was saying before, step by step. There's this big lie going around, especially in today's world on social media, that we can achieve anything right from the get-go. Even as a business owner, I was sold a huge lie saying, oh yes, you can achieve multiple six-figure revenue in 1-2 years. No problem, no big deal. Same with resilience, same with all those big programs. You need to implement these big programs and change people's culture and mindset. And no, we have to go step by step. So even when we don't have money to invest in something like this, if we go with a step-by-step and humble approach, acknowledging that we are beginners at something, then it becomes a very different ballgame. So when I'm saying step-by-step is first start a conversation. And actually, one of your guests was talking about this, about risk management as well. Start with a conversation. Start by manifesting what you're envisioning for your company to be resilient and sustainable. And by resilient, what I mean is bouncing forward. So when a child falls, when he's learning how to walk and he stands up again, that's pure resilience. And this is exactly what organizations are meant to do as they work on it, as they work and grow this muscle of theirs, right? So it's the same for those low resource NGOs. They can do the same, accepting this step by step, not comparing themselves to the big guys, because we all do this, okay? That's the second trick with those social media today, comparing ourselves to others. Accept where you are right now and accept that you have to go step by step and start by having those conversations, manifesting what you're envisioning. If you really believe in what you do, whether it's an NGO or even a business for myself, if we go step by step like this, I believe it works and it forces us to embed resilience in everything that we do. Going back to this child analogy, I also want to compare it to a household. If you're a very low resource NGO, envision this, if you are building resilience for your home, what would you do to make sure if anything happens, it's not going to impact your family too much? Because as families, we don't have huge revenues most of the time, right? So what do we do to make sure that disruptive event won't impact us too much? We first make sure we have the right contact. We first make sure we have the right network around us to help us and support us. We first ensure that we have enough cash in the bank. Very small things, but step by step. It doesn't have to be big right away.
So let me ask you, you had mentioned earlier about the focus on hard tools. I think you had mentioned policies or written documents. Yeah. So I understand, and I agree with you, because I, again, feel the same way about risk management, is I think that those documents and tools are necessary to meet some regulatory requirements and also to provide some clarity. But we know that they're not really used or referenced very much. So if you're talking about crisis response and resilience, one of the things that I've heard people talk about is continuity of operation plans. And that's, again, a written document. What are some of the other things that people would need if they're not focused on these hard tools to ensure that they are ready to respond to a crisis and be resilient?
So, of course, Sabrina, I'm 100% with you when you say that sometimes it's a compliance issue. And I was actually discussing with a client yesterday, sometimes our own clients require us to have those plans, right? And we require it from our own suppliers sometimes. And also insurance companies require it. So I get this 100%. What I'm saying is that focusing on those hard tools only is a mistake. I'm saying focusing on those and putting 100% of the energy on those hard tools and 100% of the budget on those hard tools is a mistake, because this is basically what's more or less happening. So yes, those documents are necessary, right? I have a list of phone numbers. I have a list of names. I know exactly who to go to when something goes wrong. I know exactly who my suppliers are, who my clients are, all of this, right? And it's in writing. But at the same time, I spend 50% of my time training myself and growing this muscle as a human being, because those documents will never replace those muscles. Those documents are only here to help us lift the weight, I would say. And that's what I'm saying, you know, where the mistake is. It should be more balanced between the hard tools and the soft tools. And if I was to advise a low resource NGO or any organization to invest in something to grow their resilience muscle, I would say spend 80% of your time training yourself and 20% writing a couple of documents. That's going to help, you know, with your memory. But 80% on training and making sure that people are on board and with you on this topic and understand where you're heading and where you want to go, and that if anything happens, you will need that agility, that mental agility to bounce back.
So what kind of training, when you say training? So if people are listening today and going, okay, well, I'll just get, you know, ChatGPT to write my policies for me, and then I'll have all this free time to focus on training. So what should the people who make up these organizations be focused on? What should they be learning about or receiving training on in the area of crisis and resilience? If they're not going to spend the 90% on the tools, what should they spend the 90% on?
So we can start by taking stock on what's going on, what's went on in the past. And I'm not talking as a lesson learned exercise, just taking stock, right? I don't think resilience and crisis response is an expertise. I think it's an experiential journey. And I always say it, I don't consider myself an expert. I'm just a learning person. I'm a student. And each time something has happened in my professional life, in my personal life, I've taken stock. I've analyzed what went on, whether it's for me, for my team, for my stakeholders. Always, I've done this for as long as I can remember. This is what helps us grow the muscle, because we realize the kind of skills we have, the kind of skills we need to grow, the kind of resources we already have, the resources we need to grow as well. The strength we're building over time, that doesn't cost any money to take stock. That doesn't cost any money to do this. This is an individual work.
So taking stock when it comes to reviewing what's happened in the past and then maybe doing some sort of forecasting or scenario planning? Is that another thing that people can do to strengthen their resilience and response?
It's also about getting trained on stress management. It's about getting trained on and understanding really what emotional intelligence is. It's learning on how to deal with protracted emergencies and crises and situations, right? Especially because it's nonstop disruptive, right, at this time. So we can call this protracted situation, right? And it takes a toll on people to deal with that. So getting trained on these topics as well. Understanding also that dealing with those disruptive events mean that it comes with change and conflicts. So understanding, it's all about understanding that having this awareness around these topics.
Absolutely. So give me an example then. So if you are going into working with a new client, maybe they are a small business, they don't have a lot of resources. What would be some advice, or what would be the first sort of three areas that you would look into and ask questions about to get a sense of where the organization is sort of on a continuum? continuum of being crisis prepared and resilient?
Number one, I would ask if that organization has been hit by events before. And of course, with COVID, we can say everyone has been, but regardless of COVID, I would ask because some organizations have not been hit by COVID so badly as others, right? So that's why I'm really cautious with this. But I would basically ask, have you been impacted by disruptive events in the past? Okay. Then is there someone, at least one person, who is handling this topic for you internally or not at all? And if there's one person, maybe there's two or three, right? So I will understand how big is the team looking at this topic. It doesn't have to be experts, right? But at least having people getting interest in the topic, okay? And then I would going step by step. What are you doing for it? You know, those three questions first. What are you doing about it? And based on that, I would then go and ask, what is your vision? What do you want to achieve for your NGO? Because there is also one big lie, another one that goes around. And I never want to say this to any of my stakeholders. We're not meant to be here forever and ever and ever and ever. And I think we need to have this consciousness of this as well. What I mean by this is sometimes we need to understand that organizations have to pivot in the face of adversity. Pivoting means sometimes we have to get rid of a business line or something that we've been doing for many years and it's not useful anymore because of this disruptive event that's showing us that what we're doing is not useful. So accepting that this has to die for something new to grow. So that's why, what are you envisioning for your NGO? And that also connects the word resilience to the sustainability topic as well, right? We want to be resilient, but not at all costs. We want to be sustainable at the same time. So adapting to whatever comes to us. We're learning by error, by moving forward, but sticking to this vision. And I think it should be the same for those small NGOs. It's about asking them, what is your vision for your NGO? What exactly do you want to achieve? How do you want to convey your message and things like that?
One of the things I wanted to ask you specifically about when you're going in and looking at organizations, and this refers back to what you were talking about in the beginning about silos. Can you talk a little bit more about how people get stuck in silos when it comes to crisis and resilience? And then how do you advise organizations to break out of them? Because sometimes that can be really challenging. People might feel threatened because they've built these little kingdoms. And it's not that they don't want to cooperate and collaborate, but they are just nervous about giving up control. So can you talk a little bit about silos and your thoughts on why those are important to address?
It goes back to what I was saying before, Sabrina. It goes back to the vision. So whomever set up that organization, that NGO, that small business, whatever it is, it's about the vision. If the vision is here, if the vision is clearly communicated, people are much keener to collaborate and to break those silos. That's why it goes back to the vision, to the leadership that we embody, that we convey toward this mission that we want to have. And I know it sounds simple, but it's not, because it requires a lot of energy. It requires a lot of clarity. It requires a lot of humility as well, right? Because yes, we have this vision, we have this mission, but at the same time, we want to approach this with a step-by-step approach, like I was saying. So yeah, it's a mix of all of this, I would say. And if we want people to collaborate, we want first to make sure that they are on board with what we're trying to achieve.
That's really great advice. And I think the focus on people, the focus on vision, the focus on spending that energy on the things that are important, like your organizational culture instead of the tools, is really great advice.
It does require a lot of self-awareness to do something like this, to achieve something like this, to achieve the fact that people collaborate with each other. And it goes back to this emotional intelligence topic I was talking about. There's no way we can influence others if we're not working ourselves.
Excellent. And so then if you were advising small to medium-sized, really low to no resource nonprofit organizations, specifically now about crisis management, crisis awareness, and resilience, what would be the top three risks that you would advise to these organizations to be aware of in this area?
I would say the number one is to refuse change, like I was saying before as well. Sometimes we implement some tools and programs and they've been implemented for years and people don't want to change them for whatever reason, because it's hard for everyone to change. So the number one thing is embracing change. The second one I would say, that's another one which I mentioned before, it's the simplicity, the willingness to simplify, oversimplify things. And it's a bias that we have in our brain. It's really hard to fight it, but at least having the awareness of it. Wanting to simplify things sometimes is really useful, especially when we want to speak to people who know nothing about our topics. So we want to simplify the complex terms and context and all of this. But the way we approach it, we have to embrace the complexity of it. And a third one, I would say, lack of diversity of thinking. That's a huge trap. Just to give you an idea, there was a study during COVID by an HR organization actually showing that during COVID, during the virtual world we lived in, people would tend to spend much more time speaking virtually to people that they knew close to them in their own industry than going out there and getting to know people who they didn't know at all, who come different industries, different roles, and so on and so forth. So that's a big, big, big trap we can all tend to fall in, having a lack of diversity of thinking. I'm not talking about diversity of gender or anything else here, which are important as well, but I'm talking about what we have between our two ears here, which are absolutely important when we talk about this topic, resilience, or any other topics actually, because the more we have people thinking differently, the better it will be to track biases, to track lessons learned, taking stock, because we then have different perspectives on a situation. Even in today's work with my company, I never work with people who think like me. I go out and pick people who are very different. Otherwise, there's no point. So to summarize, it's about embracing change, embracing complexity, and embracing diversity of thinking. The three things, three traps, and three opportunities at the same time.
Yeah, that's great. It's exactly like risk, right? Risk is threats, but also opportunities. Yeah. And I love how, change, embracing complexity, and embracing diversity of thought, you can look at them as, oh my gosh, how am I going to overcome this? But really, they're opportunities. They're opportunities to just think differently and prepare. Those are great. That actually takes me to my next question then. So if somebody is listening today and they are saying, oh my goodness, you know, my organization, we are just not crisis prepared. And I don't know how resilient we would be if something happened to us. How can somebody make a business case for this, for resources? And now I don't necessarily mean money resources, maybe just staff time resources, to start looking at crisis and resilience in a more structured and formalized way. What would you say would be good arguments to advocate for highlighting this issue within an organization and giving it some resources?
I would say three things. First, find stories, relevant stories to the organization. It can be a story that's already happened within the organization or a story outside the organization to which the organization can relate and connect to. Second, find data. And it doesn't have to be numbers all the time. Data can be a whole lot of things. It can be tangible data, but also intangible data. And third, connect with the people you want to influence on this. When I say connect is, you know, get some energy, basically. When we started this conversation, Sabrina, I'm actually standing up because I want to convey energy. So if I'm sitting down being all dull with my shoulders down, I'm not conveying any energy, even if my message is super interesting. So it's about really finding the right stories, finding the right data, and conveying enough energy. And of course, that requires preparation. And then you can go speak to whomever you need to speak to. And doing this, preparing on these three things, takes time, doesn't take money.
Excellent. Those are really great because sometimes with organizations, leadership and management will acknowledge and say, yeah, you know, we are not prepared in this area, but we don't have time, but we don't have resources. So those are really good examples. If someone really wants to make a motivational pitch, say, look, this is a similarly situated organization and here's what happened to them and here's what happened that didn't go very well. We don't want to be in that same position. And that can be kind of the fear factor, I guess, can be a little bit motivational sometimes too. But I think we want to maybe focus on the positive as well as the negative too.
Yeah, my point was not to focus on fear, Sabrina, excuse me here. My point was to focus on motivation and embracing, you know, linking it to the vision of the NGO. I never do my work focusing on fear, of course, because I don't think that's a way to gather people, right? Really, it's about connecting the story to the vision of the NGO. What do we want to achieve? And I would say, if we connect it to the data, it can be about something very simple, as simple as asking around, do you think we are prepared for a disruptive event? Do you think we are resilient enough? Or do you know anything about, or do you understand anything about this topic? And coming in with that very simple data, but really important data, will help actually, because they'll see, oh my God, okay, that person cares about the NGO. It's about where we put the energy on. basically, right? It's about caring and envisioning something. It's not about being scared. I'm not doing my job because I'm scared. I'm doing my job because I think it's about caring. I care about people. I care about helping organizations and teams to achieve what they want to achieve, right? It's human to human. Make sense?
Absolutely, yeah. So we've talked a lot about teams and individuals and even a little bit about leadership. I want to ask you a very specific question about board members. I always ask this question on the podcast because a lot of times in nonprofit organizations, board members or trustees or volunteers, they believe in the mission of the organizations, but maybe this is the first time they've been on a board. Maybe they're a little bit nervous. They don't entirely know what to ask or how to request things. So if you are advising board members of nonprofit organizations, if they really want to support ensuring that the organization is prepared for crisis and is resilient, what would be three questions that they could ask the senior leadership team or three pieces of data that they could request to demonstrate that they support this area and they think that it's important for the organization?
It's about asking questions. I don't know if I have any specific questions, but it's about asking questions. Because what comes to my mind when we talk about this, Sabrina, is that all too often people don't ask questions for whatever reasons, right? They don't have time. They're afraid that they're going to seem stupid, or they're afraid that the question is not interesting, whatever it is. Or just they don't think about it, basically, right? Because of the very busy schedule that we all have. And I get that. So first off, I would really encourage anyone on a board for those small organizations to go out and ask all kinds of questions to get to understand the NGO and understand where they're coming from, where they want to go, and say, okay, how can I help? How can I help you achieve that vision and achieve that mission? Instead of putting more work on those people working on, I would say, on the ground, right, doing the work for the NGOs, is like, how can I help? How can I help achieve that? Through my network, because we all have networks. And those are usually very, very helpful, especially when it comes to NGO. So how can I help? That's a very big question to ask. A second one, I would say, it's about alignment. How can we align? So how does what you do today align with you going wherever you want to go? Basically, are you prepared for anything, right? And it's about having that conversation from the get-go. I don't believe in top-down orders. And I think it's about, if we're talking about leadership, and I think board members are meant to be leaders in whatever they do, it's about onboarding people. So that's why I'm all about having conversations. Yes, the network, but also being a sounding board. You haven't been doing much on this topic. How can I help? Should we discuss about it? Because I'm a board member and support to be a sounding board as well. So I think board members should approach in a collaborative manner. And that's why I'm going back to this question, how can I help? Being a sounding board. Okay, you're not prepared on crisis management. What can we do to help you move forward on this? Maybe one of us have had this experience in the past. It's, to me, it's about collaboration.
I do love the focus on collaboration. What can we do to help? The organization should be doing this, you know, organically and shouldn't need the nudge from the board. But sometimes they don't. We know that they don't. And that's when bad things happen. So that's great advice. Thanks, Alexandra. So let me ask you this. If people are listening today and they're really interested in learning more about crisis preparedness, responding to crisis, resilience, what are some continuing education opportunities that people can use, hopefully free or inexpensive learning platforms, podcasts, blogs, reading material, classes that they can take? Anything that you can recommend for people so that they can strengthen their awareness? Like you were talking about in the beginning, it's less tools and more strengthening their own knowledge. What can you recommend for folks so that they can learn more?
So the number one thing I would advise that costs no money but takes time is connect on LinkedIn to as many people as you can, especially people interested in this topic. Talking about this topic doesn't mean they have to be deep expert, but at least talking about this topic, because LinkedIn has become an amazing network to share articles and learning opportunities. And from there, you can then decide which type of author, which type of platform you prefer, whether it's written platform or audio platform, whether it's a podcast or a book or an article or an essay. But using LinkedIn, I think, as a platform to dig and look for information on this topic is really, really useful. Takes time, but it doesn't cost anything. And then, of course, there are plenty of resources. Some of the resources which I use all the time, they are really, really good on those topics. Some yearly reports from the World Economic Forum, from McKinsey as well. Also, I want to say that there are some free training on LinkedIn on these topics. They're not super comprehensive, but you can learn the basics from them. They're free. The other thing is, we're going back to the hard tools. If you know nothing about those hard tools, go on a platform such as ISO to look at the standards. What do they say? How do they sequence the approach? I'm not saying we should stick to these standards, but at least it's a good backbone to start from.
Well, those are great resources. They're free, low cost. This is what we like for nonprofits who are facing resource challenges. So before we wrap up, is there anything else that we didn't cover that you want to share for the audience? Anything that you want to emphasize about crisis and resilience? If you were advising low to no resource charities, what would be some parting advice and words?
The one final word that I would like to reemphasize, Sabrina, is to have this step-by-step approach, to start small. No resources or barely any resources, it's fine. You can still do things. So yeah, that's really the message I want to reemphasize. Accept and embrace this step-by-step approach and starting small. It's just fine. We all start small somewhere at some point.
That's great. It's like eating the elephant, right? One bite at a time. And I think when it comes to crisis and resilience, that's great advice, is just take one step at a time and it will build over time. That's great. Wonderful. Well, Alexandra, if people want to reach out to you, if they have more questions, if they want to learn more, where can they find you out there in the world?
It goes back to what I was saying before about LinkedIn. LinkedIn is the platform to find me. I'm always available there. Super easy to find Alexandra Hoffman. Feel free to reach out and ping me and connect. I'd be happy to connect with anyone. And yes, my website, www.crisisally.com.
Great. Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for the time today, Alexandra. Really appreciated it. It was great having a conversation about crisis and resilience. And I think the folks listening today learned a lot. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Sabrina. It was a very interesting conversation to have and truly appreciate the questions. It got me thinking a lot, and it's always a good thing. Thank you very much, Sabrina.
Great. Thanks. So that's our show for today. Please remember to like, subscribe, and follow us for all your third sector risk information. Thanks for listening to Tolerable Risk.